So it's great to be here, and it's a great time to be giving this talk, because I think that this is, we're about reaching the expiration date for when theorists, like myself, go around giving talks on dark energy and ride on the coattails of these wonderful discoveries that the observers have made, and yet produce no good ideas of our own for why it is actually like this. So after today's talk, you're not allowed to hear any more talks like this until someone actually has a really good idea. Not that we don't have ideas, it's just that they're bad. Bad in the sense that either they're wildly unnatural or they're somehow not fitting the data in some important way. So today's talk will be sort of the last gasp of desperation where you say maybe there isn't any dark energy or dark matter in the universe for that matter. Maybe it's all gravity's fault. We only believe that there are components of the dark sector that make up 95% of the universe because we infer their existence from gravity. So this pie chart is something that we've seen before, at least conceptually, if not in this particular manifestation. The yellow piece of the pie chart is 5% of the universe, which is supposed to be every particle we've ever discovered in any experiment ever. 25% of the universe is dark matter. Dark matter is some kind of slowly moving mass particle that we haven't yet discovered in the laboratory, something that's not in the standard model of particle physics. And 70% of the universe is dark energy. This is a great accomplishment to have constructed this pie chart of the inventory of what the universe is made of. And it fits all the data, as long as you assume that the dark matter is cold and collisionless, and that the dark energy is smoothly distributed and slowly varying in time. However, it's remarkable, it's sort of a surprising universe for various reasons that we'll talk about, and therefore we want to sort of press against this conclusion as hard as we can. So today we're going to be talking about whether or not it's possible that we're mistaken to infer the existence of these dark sectors by plugging in our theory of gravity. So here's our theory of gravity. It's given to us by Professor Einstein. Most times when you see pictures of Einstein, his hair is all gray and he's sort of wearing a sweatshirt and stuff like that. Back when he was inventing relativity, he was a sharp-dressed young man and someone was combing his hair. I don't know who that was. So in 1912, Einstein was thinking about space and time and he had this brilliant idea. He had the idea that if you took your favorite physicist friend and you locked them in a room and didn't let them look at the outside world, and you asked them, are you in a gravitational field? They could not possibly tell you the answer. What they would do is they would drop things, they would measure things, and you would think, well, if you drop something and see it fall, there's gravity there. But that's not true, because you could do exactly the same experiment, locked in a box that was accelerating through empty space, far away from any gravity. And there isn't any possible version of that experiment you can do that can tell the difference between these two possibilities. Unlike, for example, the electric field. If you ask the physicist, is there an electric field in the box? They could drop a positively charged particle and a negatively charged particle. They would move differently. But for gravity, everything moves in exactly the same way. Things respond universally to gravity, and that makes gravity different. So if you and I had come up with that thought experiment, you'd go, oh, that's cool. Einstein, being smarter than you or I, said, that means that space-time is curved. That's why he was Einstein. Because he figured out that if gravity is truly universal, if it really acts on everything in precisely the same way, the right way to think about gravity is not as a force propagating through space-time, but as a feature of space-time itself. And what he figured out was that if you allow space-time to have a geometry, to have curvature, then what we think of as gravity is just a manifestation of that geometry. The sun warps the space-time around it, and the Earth is doing its best to move on a straight line. But there are no such things as straight lines in this curved geometry, so the Earth describes a lazy ellipse moving around in an orbit around the sun, and we call that gravity. So he didn't just say that, he came up with equations. One way of getting Einstein's equations is to write down the action. So this is the action that you would get for gravity plus matter. The action is the thing that you vary to get the equations of motion. The extremal points of the action get you the classical equations of motion. So what is the simplest possible action you could write down if what you're trying to do is understand the dynamics of the curvature of space-time? Well, general relativity is a field theory, and like any field theory, the action is going to be the integral over all space-time of some function, some number. It turns out that the simplest function you can write down that characterizes the curvature of space-time is the curvature scalar r. So if you just guess that this is the action, and then you put in an action for matter, and you vary this or differentiate it with respect to the metric, the thing that tells you how space-time is curved, you get Einstein's equation. So here's the metric, G mu nu, it's a 4x4 matrix in four dimensions. And what Einstein's equations tell you is that here is some characteristic tensor that describes the curvature of space and time. Here's stuff. Here's the energy and momentum and the heat and stress and strain of the materials that you have in space-time. And they're sourcing the space-time curvature. So you don't need to follow this in detail, but everyone should see this equation. This is one Einstein should have become famous for, not E equals mc squared. We're going to be cosmologists. Cosmologists are the shortest attention span scientists you will ever meet, because the universe is a very simple place. The universe is not complicated if you look at it over very, very large scales. In fact, it's exactly the same everywhere. If you squint and average out fluctuations, the number density of galaxies throughout the universe is more or less the same. However, it's changing as a function of time. The universe is growing. So we invent a number A, the scale factor, that tells the relative size of space at different moments in time. And that number is getting bigger. And if you trace that number back, it was close to zero. The classical equations tell us it was exactly zero, but we don't know those classical equations are right at that point. But anyway, it was certainly very close to zero. We call that the Big Bang, when everything was basically on top of everything else. So this is the kind of thing you would like to do as a professional cosmologist, is you'd like to understand what is the precise function, scale factor as a function of time, that describes the history of the universe from the Big Bang to today and beyond today. Well, to do that, we're going to plug in this physical setup, a constant density of galaxies throughout space expanding as a function of time, into Einstein's equation. So Einstein's equation says that matter, stuff, sources space-time curvature. In the case of a homogeneous and isotropic expanding universe, there are two forms of space-time curvature. One is the expansion itself. The Hubble parameter h is a dot over a, where a is the scale factor and dot is the time derivative. But you also have spatial curvature. At any one moment of time, forgetting about the expansion rate of the universe, space itself can be curved. It can be flat, like Euclid taught us. It could be positively curved or negatively curved. And the way that you would know is that if you took a big triangle and added up the angles inside, if they were exactly 180 like Euclid taught us, then space is flat. If they're greater, then space is positively curved. And if they're less than 180, then space is negatively curved. And the first person to really think about this in any systematic way was Gauss. And he actually did it. He actually went up to the mountains and put up surveying equipment to measure the angles. And he got 180 degrees to within his error bars. Had he gotten more precise instruments, he might have invented general relativity. You don't know. It's an interesting counterfactual question. So now what happens when we plug in this homogeneous and isotropic universe into Einstein's equation? Well, space-time curvature is energy and momentum. The form of energy and momentum for a homogeneous universe is just the energy density. It's the same energy density everywhere, but it changes as the universe expands. Things can dilute away, for example. But the space-time curvature, as we said, comes in two pieces. It gets a contribution from the expansion rate, which is just the Hubble parameter squared. It gets a contribution from the curvature of space, which is that curvature parameter kappa divided by the scale factor squared. So this, because h is a dot over a, is a first-order differential equation for the scale factor. And you can solve it if you tell me what is kappa, what is the curvature of space, and what is rho as a function of a. So you need to know both the actual value of the energy density. You also need to know how the energy density changes as the universe expands. So you might ask yourself, what is a plausible guess for how the energy density would change as the universe expands?
So can I ask a question just about the equation?
Sure.
If you're applying general relativity, then should kappa be a function of position in the sense that inside galaxies, where you have an overdense region, and therefore between galaxies you have an underdense region. So if you had done Euclid's experiment in galaxies, you'd have different triangle patterns between galaxies.
That's right. Absolutely true, except we're working in the approximation where there aren't any galaxies. We're working in the approximation where you're only looking at length scales measured in megaparsecs, and you've smoothed out, you've averaged out over all the galaxies. We're in a strictly homogeneous and isotropic universe. If you perturbed around this, you get exactly what you say. You get delta H, delta kappa, delta rho, all of these are dependent on space and time. So this is just a constant. Not only is kappa not dependent on space, it's not even dependent on time in this particular parameterization. the time dependence is given to you by the a squared over.
Is kappa an equation of motion?
Kappa is a fact about space. It's positively curved, negatively curved, or zero. It tells you the radius of curvature of space.
So is it a constrained parameter? So that means it has a particular value?
Yeah, it never changes. That is to say, the physical curvature of space changes, and this is the way it changes. It's a constant over a squared. So we're going to put in this universe, again, simple-minded folk cosmologists are, they say there are only two things to put in the universe. There's fast-moving particles and slow-moving particles. If particles are slowly moving, where slow means slow compared to the speed of light, the energy per particle is basically their rest energy, E equals mc squared. That is still the fourth equation. And m and c and squared are all constants in the simplest theories of physics you can write down. So the energy per particle is a constant. But the universe expands, the number, total number of particles stays the same, the number density will dilute away. The density will go away as 1 over volume, or 1 over a cubed. So the energy density in slowly moving particles goes as 1 over a cubed, and cosmologists call those particles matter. The other limit is if particles are moving at or close to the speed of light, they do not get their energy from e equals mc squared. They get their energy from e equals h nu, where nu is the frequency. And the frequency does change as the universe expands. A short wavelength blue photon is stretched into a long wavelength red photon. The frequency goes down as 1 over a. So the number density still goes down to 1 over a cubed, but the energy per particle for fast-moving particles also goes down. And you get the total energy density in what cosmologists call radiation goes as 1 over a to the 4. So you would not be surprised to learn that in an old universe, in a universe that was much, much older than whatever early universe timescales were relevant, there was more matter than radiation because the radiation goes away more quickly than the matter does. And that's true. In our universe today, the matter is bigger than radiation by a factor of about 1,000, or a little bit more than that.
But by the conservation of energy, where does the energy from the radiation go?
Conservation of energy is not true.
Not for the universe as a whole.
That's right. You have, yes. It's a frequent line.
How do you explain the difference?
If you wanted to derive the conservation of energy, you would derive it from something like time translation invariants. In an expanding universe, you are not time translation invariant. So the total energy in stuff certainly changes as the universe expands. There is still an equation. It is not delta E is zero, it's delta E equals some function of what space-time is doing. Which is not at all surprising. If you had a set of particles in a time-dependent electric field, and you didn't count the energy of the electric field, the energy of those particles would also change.
So it's energy density that's not conserved, that the energy would...
No, energy is just not conserved. The energy of a gas of photons, as the universe expands, changes, even if it's a compact universe and you can count every single photon.
The radiation has pressure, and the pressure does work against the expanding universe.
So the energy actually goes into the expansion of the universe.
Well, I was trying not to say that. There isn't an equation like this for the energy density of space-time itself. So it's safer. I think it's just as true and conceptually simpler to talk about what happens to the energy density of stuff, which is that the total energy does change in a way that you can calculate given what space-time is.
Although at the beginning, the density of radiation was near 1.
Goes to infinity, as a matter of fact, yes.
Then that energy increases towards 0 at late times, so and the energy is going into space time, then the difference between radiation on the era and future is that the energy does go into space time.
I don't want to pass judgment over whether or not that's a good way of thinking about it. I don't want to think about it that way. Now, I want to think about it as saying energy is not conserved in the expanding universe. It obeys an equation, but the equation is not saying that energy is conserved. It does something. It can go up, or it can go down, which is not conserved. Okay, so here are the two things you might want to put in there. Let's measure how much there is. You can count the photons. The matter is harder, because the matter can hide from you. The matter could be dark. In fact, the matter is dark. There's a simple thing you can do. You can weigh the total amount of mass in a cluster of galaxies by using the gravitational lensing of tiny galaxies in the background of that cluster. This is a computer reconstruction, not a simulation, but a reconstruction based on data of where the matter is in this cluster of galaxies, and all these little orange dots are galaxies. The blue haze is the total mass density, and there's a total amount of mass that is dominated by stuff other than ordinary matter. If I had more time, I would explain to you how we know, strictly speaking, how much ordinary matter there is in the universe. Both from Big Bang nucleosynthesis and from the cosmic microwave background, we have independent measurements on the total amount of ordinary matter, and it's not nearly enough to explain the stuff in this cluster of galaxies or many other clusters of galaxies. There's about five times as much matter in the universe as there is ordinary matter in the universe. So there's something else. We call it dark matter. It's something we haven't yet discovered. But we can measure how much there is. So we can use this idea, there's a lot of matter in the universe, there's a little bit of radiation, to make a prediction. We can make a prediction for what the scale factor should do. Here's the Friedman equation again. The h squared is proportional to rho. H squared is a dot over a. And I've written rho as rho matter plus rho radiation, a constant over a cubed plus a constant over a to the fourth. And there's a curvature term. So I can multiply both sides by a squared to get an equation for a dot squared. And I notice that a dot squared is proportional to something that only has inverse powers of a in it. Something that as a goes up will always go down. So in a universe with nothing but matter and radiation, we have a prediction that a dot should be going down. You should live in a decelerating universe. That's why you see this picture drawn this way. And it makes intuitive sense. The universe is expanding, but all the stuff in the universe is pulling on all the rest of the stuff, which slows the expansion down. So that makes a prediction in a matter and radiation dominated universe if you believe the Friedman equation. The prediction has been tested, and sadly, it is not true. That is not what the universe actually does. The universe right now is accelerating. If you look at type 1a supernovae, which are basically the same kinds of events, a type 1a supernova is a white dwarf star onto which some friend of it has dribbled matter, and it reaches a limit where it can't hold up anymore, it collapses and explodes. And that limit, the Chandrasekhar limit, is basically the same for every white dwarf anywhere in the universe. So these explosions are standard candles. And you can plot in weird astronomer's units size of the universe versus how far away these supernovae are. And two groups overtook this challenge. And this bottom curve here is the prediction in a universe that was nothing but matter and had the critical density, no spatial curvature. It is very far away from the data. This is a universe that has matter and also a little bit of curvature. It is closer to the data, but statistically still not consistent with it. This curve up here is one in which the universe is not decelerating. It has recently begun to accelerate in the history of the universe. Given the equation that we had here, the only way to make a dot go up, the only way to explain an accelerating universe, is to have some form of energy density on the right-hand side which doesn't go away as the universe expands, which doesn't dilute away as a to the minus 3 or a to the minus 4, but it's nearly constant. We call whatever that is dark energy. So it's not true that we know nothing about dark energy. We have some constraints on what it must be to fit the data. It is smoothly distributed through space. It's about the same amount, 10 to the minus 8 ergs per cubic centimeter of dark energy everywhere. If there were much more dark energy in clusters than outside, we would have detected it using gravitational lensing or something like that. It has negative pressure. We invent a parameter, the equation of state parameter, W, which is the pressure divided by the energy density, and that's minus 1 or thereabouts. Really, this statement is just a translation of the following statement. The density varies slowly, if at all, as a function of time. In terms of this equation of state parameter W, the energy density of dark energy goes as the scale factor to the minus 3 times 1 plus W. So for matter, which is slowly moving, W is 0, and it goes to a to the minus 3. For radiation, which is fast moving, W is a third, it goes to a to the minus 4. If you want something that doesn't decay away, something for which a, for which rho is approximately constant, you want W to be close to minus 1, negative pressure. So that makes the universe accelerate at late times, and you want to ask, what is this stuff that is making the universe accelerate? Given that the data are saying that it's smoothly distributed in space and slowly varying with time, the simplest guess for what the dark energy could be is that it is exactly constant everywhere throughout space and everywhere as a function of time. A fixed number that doesn't change throughout the history of the universe. And that is what we call vacuum energy, or what Einstein called the cosmological constant. an inherent minimum amount of energy in every cubic centimeter of space that doesn't change through space or time. So in the best tradition of NASA, this is a false colored image of the vacuum energy. This is a cubic centimeter of space that I took a photograph of and enhanced it to make it look like a pulsing blue cube of energy. The point is that the idea of vacuum energy is you take a little cubic centimeter of space and remove everything from it. Remove all the dark matter, all the radiation, all the ordinary matter, so it's empty. And you ask, what is the energy of that empty cubic centimeter of space? And in general relativity, there's no reason for the answer to be zero. It's a constant of nature, the energy density of empty space, and that is what Einstein called the cosmological constant. Alternatively, it could be dynamical, so I'll mention that a little bit later on. Actually, it probably won't, but it could be dynamical. This is a wild idea that empty space has energy, so you want to test it, and it has been tested. So you can look at the cosmic microwave background. This is a snapshot of what the universe looked like when it was 380,000 years old. These are tiny fluctuations in temperature from place to place that grew into the galaxies and large-scale structure we see today. And if you look at this picture and take the Fourier transform in your head, you go, aha, there is power at 1 degree across the sky. And that 1 degree allows us to draw a big triangle, because we know what size that should be. It should be 380,000 light years across. And furthermore, we know how far away the microwave background is. So the angular scale that is subtended by these splotches on the CMB gives us a triangle with which we can judge the total energy density of the universe. And the answer is it adds up to 1. It adds up to exactly what it should be in units to make the universe spatially flat. So the universe is spatially flat, but there's not enough matter to make it spatially flat. 70% of the energy density must be in something other than matter. There is another test you can do using large-scale structures. This is the power spectrum of matter fluctuations from very large scales to very small scales over about 5 orders of magnitude. And the shape of this curve depends not only on the stuff in the universe, but also on the expansion history. And it's consistent with there being dark energy. So we end up with a picture like this, which you've probably seen before. You can parameterize the density of the universe in terms of omega, the density that it would have if it were spatially flat. So the microwave background is telling us that omega is 1. The universe, yes, in fact, is spatially flat. So if you decompose omega into omega for matter and for vacuum energy, you live on the curve where the sum is close to 1. Clusters of galaxies and other dynamical measurements tell you that omega matter by itself is approximately 0.3, and the supernovae are telling you that omega vacuum energy is greater than 0. So there are two nice things about this plot. One is that these constraints overlap at the same point, where omega matter is 0.3, omega lambda is 0.7. The second is that even if you removed any one of these constraints, the overlap region would not change. It would not get bigger. So you don't have to believe in supernovae, or you don't have to believe in the microwave background. You still are stuck with the conclusion that the universe is accelerated and dominated by dark energy. You can disbelieve in 2 or more of the sets of data, but then why start paying attention to data at all? You can just invent whatever universe you like. In the universe in which we live, it's accelerating, and we attribute that to dark energy. So we have this picture, 5%, 25%, 70%. It's a very good fit to all sorts of data. 10 years ago, if you said the universe was dominated by dark energy, you'd be laughed at. Today, you can't get a PhD in cosmology without demonstrating the universe is dominated by dark energy. That's the good news. The bad news is it makes us nervous. There are issues that this universe has. For example, why is the vacuum energy so small? First, you're shocked at the idea that empty space can have energy. But once you get used to that, you start asking, well, what should the empty space energy density be? How much energy density should there be? Of course, in quantum field theory, empty space is not boring. Empty space is alive with fluctuations, virtual particles popping in and out of existence for exactly the same reason that a simple harmonic oscillator has jiggles in its vacuum state. There are zero-point fluctuations. And zero-point fluctuations in a quantum field theory show up as particle-antiparticle pairs that pop into existence and then annihilate. We know that these virtual particles are there. Saying that maybe they don't exist is not an option. We've detected their effects, for example, in the Landschrift of atomic physics, where in any of the precision tests of the electroweak theory, they're done in particle physics. We detect the effects of, for example, photons coupling to virtual electron-positron pairs. But we know that gravity couples to everything. So if these E plus E minus pairs are there, coupling to photons, they should be there, coupling to gravitons. And the effect that they should have is to contribute to the vacuum energy. You can add up the effects. You can figure out what the contribution should be. And the contribution of all these fluctuating virtual particles is infinity. You predict that the vacuum energy should be infinity. This does not worry you, because you are a highly trained quantum field theorist. You've seen infinity before, you know how to deal with it. You will say, I will regulate my theory. I'll put a cutoff, and some younger person than I will explain why the cutoff is there. So, for example, you could say, well, most of the contribution to the vacuum energy came from modes that were very, very small wavelengths, wavelengths that were smaller even than the Planck length. But I don't really believe, but I understand what space-time is doing at the Planck length. That's where quantum gravity should become important. So let me just say, completely ad hoc, that there is no contribution from modes below the Planck length. Then what do I get? Then I get a finite value for the vacuum energy of one Planck energy per Planck volume. That turns out to be 10 to the 120 times the vacuum energy we actually observe, which is a bad, even by cosmology, disagreement between theory and observation. It is often said this is the largest difference between theory and observation ever in the world, which always tempts me to write a paper which has a bigger discrepancy between my theory and observations, but I haven't done that yet. Maybe someone in the room has done that. Yes?
I didn't quite understand. So you're ignoring the physics beyond, below Planck scale.
Yes.
Are you still including graviton coupling?
Sure.
Oh, I see.
They don't, it doesn't matter, but I can include it if you like.
Suppose we ignore that. What happens to that number? You
know? It doesn't change.
Just photons would give you the same number?
Basically, this is the contribution you get per degree of freedom in whatever model you have, per massless degree of freedom anyway. You can change this, you know, if you add a couple more degrees of freedom here and there, you can change this by an order of magnitude or two. That is not going to change things. You could change things dramatically if you had a very delicate cancellation of this number. It turns out that bosons give you a positive contribution and fermions give you a negative contribution. So if you were motivated by this to start canceling them, you would invent supersymmetry. And then you would notice that there is no spin zero, 500 MeV, 0.5 MeV selectron with charge minus one lying around, and you'd be in trouble. Supersymmetry doesn't really make this better. It changes it, but doesn't really make it better. So rather than talking about solving these problems, let's just imagine that we're trying to think big and forgetting about why the vacuum energy is small. Let's imagine that, well, I should back up a little bit. Let me explain the motivation here. We thought that the vacuum energy would be zero. Why did we ever think that? When we calculated it's infinity, or at least it's much, much bigger than we observed, why would anyone think that because it should be infinity, it must be zero? The answer is, in the space of all theories we haven't yet invented, it was judged that it would be easier to someday invent a theory that made this big number zero than a theory that made this big number exactly 10 to the minus 120. It's like you meet someone who's flipping a coin, and they flip a coin and they say, guess what it is, and you say heads, and it turns out to be tails. And they flip it again and it's tails, and again and it's tails, and they flip it 300 times in a row and it's tails every time. And they say, okay, you don't understand why it fails every time. You don't know what is going on, whether he's tricking you, whether the coin is not fair, or whatever. But he says, guess what it's going to be the next time I flip it? You're going to say tails. And he flips it and tails. That is what the universe has done to us with the vacuum energy. We don't know why it's small, but the first 300 terms of its binary expansion were zero. We guess that the next one will be zero, and it turned out to be one. It's a little annoying. So what we're going to do is say, well, maybe it's not one. Maybe the vacuum energy really is zero. Maybe the dark sector of the universe is not stuff, is not an energy density, is a sign that gravity is changing. This is the kind of thing that cosmologists talk about at coffee breaks all the time. You know, maybe there isn't any dark matter. Maybe general relativity is going wrong on large scales. The problem with that is that you begin to think that you could explain anything. If you don't know anything about how gravity works on very large scales, then you can fit any kind of data at all. How predictable is it? The good news is that there are rules to this game. You can't just have anything happen. It's a field theory. It's a field theory in the infrared. It's the very largest scales that we're looking at. It should be possible to write down an actual theory with a Lagrangian and action and so forth and get predictions out of it. And it will turn out those predictions are extremely highly constrained. The punchline of everything that I'm telling you in this talk will be that it's much harder to fiddle with general relativity at very large scales and remain consistent with all the experimental tests than you might think. So here are the rules of the game. We want to change our theory of gravity. General relativity is a field theory. How should we change it? Field theories are characterized by a set of degrees of freedom, like vibrational modes in a solid or something like that. We have a set of fields, and those fields have components. Some of those components are dynamical, true degrees of freedom. Others are constrained. They're algebraically determined in terms of other fields. So you need to tell me what degrees of freedom, how many there are, what their spins are in your new theory. Then you need to tell me how they propagate. Are they massive fields that give rise to short-range Yukawa-like interactions? Are they massless fields that give rise to long-range Coulomb-type interactions? The photon and the graviton act like that, or maybe it could be more inventive. Finally, you need to tell me how they interact. How do they couple to other fields? How do they couple to themselves? And once you give me all these things, you have a theory, and then you can start making predictions.
Yeah, Sean, so you're trying to explain some phenomena that we have evidence for at very long distances and not at short distances. So why are you keeping the axioms of local field here? Why do you assume it's a local field?
I got to start somewhere. In my experience, if something is not going to be described by local field theory, it's more likely to break down at short distances rather than long distances. So I'm just going to assume that at long distances, local field theory is just as good at gigaparsec scales as it is at centimeter scales. That's not to say that that assumption is necessarily right, but that's the assumption I'm going to start with. You never know, but this is where we're going to start. So this is what you would want to give me. For example, just to fix our ideas, here's how you would have done that if you thought of inventing general relativity in these. General relativity is described as a massless spin tube graviton. The graviton we haven't seen yet, of course. If you're not, if you haven't tried to quantize gravity, you might even say, how do you know there are gravitons around if you haven't quantized gravity? But really, what you do even classically is talk about tiny perturbations in the gravitational field propagating through space-time. And at a purely classical level, you can describe these as plane wave modes with certain interactions and certain propagations, and those modes are precisely gravitons. If you then quantize those modes in the weak field regime, they would show up as particles, but that's not really relevant to what we're doing here. We're just doing classical field theory. So these modes are spin two, they're massless, and what do? They couple to the energy momentum tensor, both of matter fields and of themselves. This is famously one way to derive Einstein's equations, is to make sure the gravitons couple to their own energy momentum tensor, and you bootstrap your way up to eventually you get all of Einstein's equations. So a spin two massless field does this. This is something that you know. You've seen this picture before from lectures on gravitational wave detection. What does a gravitational wave do? You have a ring of test particles floating in empty space. A gravitational wave goes by, and one of two things happens. Either it begins to oscillate up and then sideways and back and forth in a plus sign, or it begins to oscillate in an X sign, a times symbol, that looks either like this or like that. These are the two polarizations of a massless spin two graviton in exactly the same way as the two polarizations of a massless spin one photon are the ones that make the electron go up and down and the ones that make the electron go right and left. So those two polarizations are separated by 90 degrees. That's what makes a photon spin one. These two polarizations are separated by 45 degrees. That's what makes a graviton spin two, even if you don't quantize it. But once you start thinking in that way, you go, okay, I have this ring of particles. It has these two things it can do. What else could it do? One thing it could do is it could change its area. The effects of these two polarizations don't change the area of your ring of particles. If you had a mode where the ring of particles just got bigger and smaller, that would correspond to a spin zero graviton, something that is not predicted by general relativity, but is easy enough to add in. You say, I want to add in this degree of freedom. That's no problem. In fact, if you think about these little pictures, you might say, those pictures look just like the fundamental modes of a little vibrating loop of string. And you'd be right. In fact, if you started from the other side and said, what are the fundamental modes of a little vibrating loop of string, you would find these, and that is why string theory predicts gravity. This is why string theory in the late 60s, early 70s went from being a theory of the strong interactions to a theory of gravity, because as long as you have closed strings, you have this mode, and gravity is in fact described by this. It's not a coincidence that this picture looks both like vibrating strings and the polarization states of the gravitational wave. And string theory predicts this. It predicts a spin zero graviton called the dilaton, which has not been observed. One of the issues in connecting string theory to the real world is explaining why this spin zero field and many other fields are not observed in nature. So, forgetting about string theory for the moment, going back to this scalar tensor theory. We have a tensor, which is the graviton that Einstein knew about. I don't know if you knew about it or not, but the fluctuations of the metric that are spin 2 are described by this tensor. What if we added a scalar? What if we added a spin 0 graviton to our theory? At the classical level, what that means is taking this equation from Einstein and adding this scalar field, which does two things. The scalar field has its own energy momentum, and it comes outside and affects the strength of gravity so that you get a variable Newton's constant. So if the scalar field were different from place to place, you would interpret this function, f of phi, as the local value of 8 pi g, so gravity could get stronger or weaker depending on the value of the scalar. We know that the scalar is not doing anything dramatic in the solar system. This is a picture of the Cassini satellite, which we told NASA had its purpose to take pictures of Saturn. Really, the purpose of Cassini was to beam back signals to Earth to let us test general relativity. You could test the timing that these signals took as they went through the gravitational field of the sun. And of course, there's a time delay effect in general relativity, which fit precisely the data that you got from Cassini. So general relativity is pretty good in the solar system. One way to quantify how good it is in terms of the Bronsticky parameter, little omega, which has the property that omega is infinity in general relativity. In a generic scalar tensor theory that you would write down, omega would be of order 1. So the experiments are telling you that omega is 40,000, which is close to infinity, as far as being close to order 1 is concerned. So in the solar system, the space-time metric is very close to what general relativity predicts. Either there is no scalar degree of freedom in gravity, or it is somehow hidden from us. It's somehow massive, or somehow doesn't couple in obvious ways. Okay, that's the general framework. So that was supposed to convince you that this game that we play of modifying gravity on large scales, as long as we do stick to the rules of classical field theory, is a game that does have rules. You can't just do anything. Once you give me a set of degrees of freedom and what they do, I can then start making predictions.
So I suppose this Bronsticky parameter has an error bar on it, but have deviations from G of been observed in this measurement? I mean, it's 40,000 here, but...
It's greater than 40,000.
Okay, so...
So no deviations. Yes, it's between 40,000 and infinity, inclusive. So no one in this... Because the Cassini and other time delay measurements have not seen any deviation from general relativity. The closest within the solar system is something called the Pioneer anomaly, where the Pioneer spacecraft launched in the 70s, floating towards the outer edges of the solar system, seemed to be experiencing an anomalous acceleration, which I and many other people think is most likely due to the fact that these are anisotropic spacecraft and they're radiating anisotropic. But it could be because gravity is different beyond the orbit of Neptune. You never know. So, here's an example of someone who tried to invent a better theory of gravity than Einstein. Milgram, in 1984, did two things, and I want to distinguish between the two things because they're both interesting and important. One is more, can go away, the other doesn't go away. The thing that doesn't go away is an empirical fact about the behavior of stuff in spiral galaxies. In spiral galaxies, here's a picture of a galaxy, and here's the rotation curve. Here's the circular velocity of stuff orbiting around this galaxy. And if there were no dark matter in the galaxy, and Isaac Newton were right, at very far distances, this would trail off. As you get further and further away from an object, your circular velocity due to gravity goes down. But in galaxy after galaxy, that doesn't happen. The rotation curves are flat. Traditionally, this is interpreted as evidence for dark matter, since Vera Rubin did this in the 1970s. Now, if you ask, where does it happen that you begin to need to invoke the existence of dark matter? Very close to the center of galaxies, you don't need dark matter to explain the rotation curve. It's going up just because there's more and more matter in there. There's some crossover point where you begin to need to start talking about dark matter in order to fit these data. And that point of crossover is not the same distance. It's not the same physical size for every galaxy. For more massive galaxies, it's further away. The first thing that Milgram did is to notice that in every galaxy, when you ask what is the acceleration due to gravity, in the good old Newtonian sense, at the point where dark matter becomes necessary, you always get the same answer. You get this answer, 10 to the minus 8 centimeters per second squared, which in units where c equals 1 is about the Hubble constant of the same order of magnitude. So that's interesting, and it's a fact about how the universe behaves. It's even true for types of galaxies that had not been observed when Milgram made this observation. That's the first thing. The second thing is he said, well, maybe this is because gravity is true. Maybe it's not that there's dark matter there. Maybe we're not going to derive this empirical relation from the cold dark matter model. Maybe Newton's law changes, that as you get to accelerations that are less than this a naught, gravity, the force of gravity goes down like 1 over r, not like 1 over r squared. And this actually fits the data very well as long as you restrict your attention to galaxies, individual galaxies. The problem is, you want to say, well, what about gravitational lensing or the expansion of the universe? This is not a theory. This is not obeying the rules that I gave you. He didn't give us a set of degrees of freedom. He just gave us a law that works in spiral galaxies. So we want to do better than that. And finally, 20 years later, Bekenstein came up with a theory that actually has an action. So in 2004, he invented a theory called TEVIS, tensor vector scalar. And you say, well, why did it take 20 years from Milgram in 1984 to Bekenstein in 2004 to come up with an action? And I think once you actually see what the action looked like, you will know the answer to that. This is not something that you would have just invented in the shower. 4 plus 2 minus 4, you know, it's all these little numbers matter in some sense. So he has the good old gravity action in there. Then there's a vector field that points in some time-like direction throughout the universe. It is coupled in a weird way to this scalar field, and then there's this potential, which is really for a non-dynamical Lagrange multiplier field eta, that changes the kinetic term for phi. Not something you stumble on by accident, but Bekenstein says it fits the data, it fits the data in the sense that it reconstructs Milgram's law for individual galaxies. And because it's a theory, here are the degrees of freedom, vector, scalar. They propagate in a certain way, you get the equations of motion. You can make predictions for the expansion of the universe, the microwave background, what have you. It turns out this theory does pretty well for the expansion of the universe in the microwave background and for clusters of galaxies if you assume one crucial feature, which is dark matter. So it turns out that even Mond all by itself, Milgram's modified force law, if you try to extend it from galaxies to clusters of galaxies, it doesn't work. It should work. There isn't any ambiguity in there, but it doesn't fit. It's off by factors of order 5 or something like that. So the same thing is true in Bekenstein's theory. You need to assume that there is dark matter in clusters of galaxies. About omega 0.17, which is pretty close to the omega 0.25 you need in ordinary dark matter models. The difference here is that you don't need dark matter in individual galaxies. So that in this theory, the dark matter can be hot dark matter, such as neutrinos. Neutrinos actually exist in the standard model, so there's some slight improvement. However, I don't actually want to focus on talking about TEVIS or any other specific model. I want to instead remind you, since you've probably seen this already, I want to give you my version of what we've learned from the bullet cluster. This is a result that came out last August. If you're a practiced observational cosmologist, you look at this picture from the Hubble Space Telescope and you go, aha, two clusters of galaxies. Here's a cluster right there, there's a cluster right there. Everything you see in this picture, except for that blue thing, is a galaxy. There are a lot of galaxies in the universe. There's a cluster right there, there's a cluster right there. You could take their redshifts and find they are, in fact, associated with each other. These are not just a random superposition of faraway galaxies. So it is nevertheless a fact about clusters of galaxies that even the ordinary matter in a typical large cluster of galaxies is not in the galaxy. Even the hydrogen and helium is mostly in between the galaxies in the form of hot intergalactic gas and dust. We know it's there because it's so hot, it's fallen into the potential well of this cluster of galaxies, and it heats up just from the gravitational energy. It heats up so much that it emits X-rays, and you can take pictures of the X-ray gas in clusters and count the total number of hydrogen and helium, and it's more than you get in the individual galaxies. So when you do that for the bullet cluster, you get a very interesting result. This is the image from Chandra X-ray satellite of where the gas is and you find that the hot X-ray gas is not located in the same place as the galaxies are. Here are the galaxies in that cluster. Here are the galaxies in that cluster. They're offset from the gas. This is a shock front. That's why it's called the bullet cluster. Because the explanation here is that these two clusters went through each other. They collided. And the galaxies are just like test particles. They just go right by. They're not interrupted. But the gas does collide with the gas from the other cluster. You get the shock front. And these dynamics have moved the location of the gas from the actual galaxy. So now you have a place where you can ask the question, where is the gravity in this system? If the gravity is somehow being sourced by ordinary matter, even if the force law is not 1 over r squared, it still should point in the direction of the ordinary matter, not in the direction of the cluster, of the galaxies. And you can figure that out using gravitational lensing. Yes?
Moth and I just put a paper on the bullet cluster on the archive. And I don't know if you've kind of looked at Moffat's modified gravity, but it certainly doesn't obey a Newtonian force law. It's not Bond either. But we were able to fit the bullet cluster data, particularly because this dislocation, as you describe it, is just a dislocation between the peaks. This X-ray gas cloud is actually quite large and actually includes the galaxy, so the galaxy would be a certain distance from the peak, but still well within the ICM gas.
Okay, let me finish my bullet cluster spiel, and then we can talk more about what I think you can and cannot conclude from it. So this is where the gas is. You want to know where the gravity is, and you look at the distortion of the background galaxy to measure the gravitational potential, and here's where the gravity is in this cluster of galaxies. This is the inferred gravitational potential for weak lensing of the background. What you find is that the gravity is centered on where the galaxies are, where the visible galaxies are. This is exactly what you would expect if the gravity in this set of two clusters is being caused by a set of collisionless particles that just went right through each other when the two components of the bullet cluster collided, where the ordinary matter got stuck. So you see gravity, ordinary matter, they're not in the same place. If you put them on top of each other, what you find is that in this system, the gravity is pointing in a direction which is not where the matter mostly is. So my claim is that the only way you can possibly explain these data with a modified theory of gravity is if your modified theory of gravity has independently propagating degrees of freedom in it, and the energy momentum tensor of those independently propagating degrees of freedom sources the gravitational field out here, is not directly tied to the matter. And we have a name for that, and the name is dark matter. There's no Gauge-invariant distinction between modifying gravity and inventing a new dark matter candidate if what you're doing is adding new degrees of freedom and letting them independently propagate. So I don't draw any conclusions about what theory is right from this. I don't say it rules out Mond or it rules out this or whatever. What I say is that what this says, the gravity is pointing in a direction other than where the ordinary matter is. The only way to do that is new degrees of freedom, and I will call that dark matter, and therefore this shows that dark matter really does exist.
I think the difference between what you're saying and the modified gravity approach, which pushes the Gauge-invariant field to the left-hand side of Einstein's equation, is that in modified gravity, you will never find a candidate for the dark matter particle. Whereas if dark matter really exists, one day we will actually find it and be able to produce it in the lab.
Well, as long as you have some new propagating degree of freedom, you could someday produce it in the lab. Might be hard.
Well, if it's a gravitational degree of freedom, yes, it would be rather hard not just to produce most of the matter.
Yeah, but it exists. So it's a new degree of freedom. That's right. And so, again, I'm not saying what is right and what is wrong. What I'm saying is that this is evidence that the correct theory of gravity is not just a modified force law with a different fall law. The only way you can explain this by a modified theory of gravity is if your modified theory of gravity knows that the force due to gravity should point in the direction of where the matter would have been had it been collisionless. And the only way to do that is when you have new degrees of freedom. Okay. What I really want to talk about for the whole talk, and I'm only left with 10 minutes to do it, is can you get rid of dark energy by modifying gravity? It's much easier to talk about getting rid of dark energy because we know less about dark energy than we do about dark matter. However, you first might guess, let's just change the Friedman equation, which governs the expansion of the universe, once and for all. Here's the Friedman equation, where I've set the curvature of the universe equal to zero. How well do we know whether this equation is true? Interestingly, our best empirical data for the truth of this equation comes from the very early universe. It does not come from now. It comes from the time the universe was a minute old, when it was a nuclear reactor undergoing Big Bang nucleosynthesis, turning individual protons and neutrons into light elements, helium, helium-3, lithium, and deuterium. The rate of expansion of the universe when it was a minute old dramatically affects the relative abundance of these different isotopes. So you can ask the question, what would the universe look like if the expansion rate had been different? Here's a plot of size of the universe versus expansion rate. The red curve is the prediction of standard lambda CDM, so cosmological constant cold dark matter. You see that the slope of this curve depends on what is dominating the universe. In the radiation-dominated area, you get this steep slope. In the matter-dominated area, it's slightly more shallow. In the vacuum-dominated area, it's zero. And the fact that we live right there at the bump is, of course, the coincidence scandal, the fact that the dark energy and the matter content of the universe are comparable today. So what we asked is, what could the universe be doing differently at early times to give us the same light element abundances? And the answer are these little line segments, which on the one hand tell us there are slightly different things the universe could have been doing. On the other hand, they're all pretty close to the standard model. So I think that the correct lesson to take from this is that gravity was more or less conventional when the universe was a minute old. If you're going to change general relativity in such a way as to make the universe accelerate, you want to make it accelerate now, not back then. In other words, there's a scale in the problem. The modification of gravity kicks in at some late time in the universe. You need to invent a scale-dependent modification. So here is the simplest possible attempt to do that. You go from Einstein's action, which is the integral of the curvature scalar, and you say, what could I do to this action to change it in such a way that the change only kicks in at late times? Well, at late times, the curvature is small. So you put in some perturbation to this equation, which only is important when r becomes small. The simplest one is just a constant, but Einstein already did that. That is the vacuum energy. The second simplest one is a reciprocal, 1 over r, or really some small parameter over r. So this action is perfectly well defined. It's a different function of the Ricci scalar, but it's a function. It has the property that r equals 0 is not going to be a solution. Minkowski space is not going to solve this equation. And what will happen if you plug it in is the universe will accelerate at late times. Because Minkowski space is not a solution, at late times when the universe empties out, this new term kicks in and the universe begins accelerating. That's the good news. The bad news is that this modification changes the number of degrees of freedom in the theory. It is no longer true that you're only propagating a massless spin 2 particle. This theory also propagates a massive spin 0 particle, a scalar degree of freedom. And that is, in fact, ruled out by solar system test general relativity. So no matter how small you make that parameter, there is not a smooth limit in which you get general relativity back. By putting this term in there, you have discontinuously changed the theory by adding a new degree of freedom. And there's no way that you can fix it just by changing the numbers. So the reason why we did this is not because we think that this theory is probably right, because you hope to learn something. I think we did learn something. You learned that it's easy to mess with the number of degrees of freedom in general relativity. And if you're going to get around that, you're going to have to think more cleverly. It's almost a theorem that you can't think more cleverly, but the word almost is very important. Here's the almost theorem.
Sean, can I ask
sure.
A quick one? So is there still any amount of controversy with the Palatini version of this?
I don't think it's controversial, but I think the answer is very different to the Palatini version. So in the Palatini version, there is not a new degree of freedom, if I understand it correctly. So that's just—it's just in when you modify that Lagrangian, so it's not r but some function of r. It is no longer true that treating the metric and the connection as independent, the variable quantities gives you the same equations of motion. So they're just two different theories.
Yeah. So what I was trying to ask is whether as far as I know, I read only independent
yeah.
paper on this. And I think you made a strong case that it was ruled out for perhaps different reasons, but ruled out.
Yeah, I will actually talk about that in a second. That is a good question. I'll talk about it very, very briefly. So here's the almost theorem. if you want to modify gravity in the infrared, long distances, in weak fields, but you don't want to add new degrees of freedom, because then they would be ruled out in the solar system. However, general relativity in the weak field at long distances is a theory of massless spin tube gravitons coupled to their energy momentum transfer. And like I mentioned before, you can work backwards. Once you start with a theory of massless spin tube gravitons coupled to their own energy momentum transfer, that theory is basically unique. It's general relativity. So you can't do it. That would be the approximately true theorem. So then you look for loopholes in that theorem. What are the loopholes? One loophole is that the scalar degree of freedom really does exist, but somehow you didn't notice it. So Justin invented a way to do that, called the chameleon mechanism, where if you squeeze the potential for this scalar field in between its raw potential and the effects created by matter, you can give it temporarily a large mass within gravitating bodies, and that hides the effects. I'm not going to talk about that. Another possibility is to add other curvature invariants, which can also give a local large mass to these degrees of freedom. I'm not going to talk about that either. The second loophole is to say, look, we're not really interested in modifying gravity in the infrared in some abstract sense. We're interested in modifying the Friedmann equation. H squared is proportional to rho. But the Friedmann equation has nothing to do with degrees of freedom or propagating gravitons or anything like that. It is a constraint equation. It says, you give me rho, I will tell you H. There's no degrees of freedom in that equation. There's no initial data that you give. So you could imagine changing the constraint structure of general relativity without changing the number of degrees of freedom, and getting a theory that does modify the Friedmann equation without running into solar system problems. So you could change Einstein's equation, g mu nu is h by g t mu nu, to g mu nu is some function of the energy momentum tension. How do you do that? Can you do that? The answer is yes. You do it with this thing called modified source gravity. So really, I'm going to just zip through this a little bit. But modified source gravity says you have an equation of motion that looks just like the equation of motion for scalar tensor gravity. There's a scalar field psi, it has an energy momentum tensor, it modifies the strength of Newton's constant. The difference is that in scalar tensor theory, psi had its own equation of motion. It was freely propagating all by itself. In this theory, psi will turn out to be algebraically determined. There's an equation that tells you what psi is in terms of the matter fields. So psi is not an independently propagating degree of freedom, it's just a function of the matter fields. U here is a function that you put into the theory, it's part of your definition, just like the potential is in an ordinary scalar theory. So there's some function of this potential that is set equal to the trace of the energy momentum tensor. So if you know what the matter fields are doing, you know what this field psi is. So then you can plug in this energy momentum tensor, you can plug it in here. So this right-hand side is just a really complicated function of the energy density and pressure of the matter fields. There are no new things on the right-hand side of this equation. So there's no new degrees of freedom, and this is called modified source gravity. It turns out that this theory is dynamically equivalent to what Eric was mentioning, the Palatini version of F of R gravity. Which is if you take f of r gravity and you separately vary it with respect to the connection and the metric, you will get a theory that doesn't have any degrees of freedom, and in fact it's equal to this. So what is the problem with that? The problem with that is that the energy momentum tensor, what can I say? The source of gravity is a nonlinear function of the energy momentum tensor, which means that if I have two objects, their gravitational field is not the gravitational field of one plus the gravitational field of the other one. And that's a problem, because that means that you don't know how to do the averaging over a little macroscopic body in terms of the atoms that make it up. When you smooth things out, do you count the energy momentum tensor of each electron? Do you get its wave function and get the expectation value of its energy density? Or what do? In general relativity, you don't have to answer that question. In this theory, you do. So we don't know how to answer that question. And therefore, I think that in this simple form, this theory is a non-starter. But the theory might very well, this problem occurs literally at the level of atoms. So some smart person might very well be able to invent a way to do this smoothing, maybe by adding new degrees of freedom or smoothing things out in some interesting way, and get the same macroscopic equations. So I will ask what those macroscopic equations do. Well, here's your effective Friedmann equation. H squared, 8 by g over 3 times rho, plus a bunch of new terms which depend on psi. But remember, psi is just a function of rho. So really, the right-hand side of this equation is just some nonlinear function of the energy density. It's not rho anymore. It's some function of rho. And you can pick it, basically, by picking this function u of psi. So we pick a certain very simple version of it, and what you get is an effective equation of state, which is minus 1, and what observers would think is a dark energy density, which actually goes down for the most of the history of the universe, and then goes up just a little bit at the very end. Yes?
Yeah. So how do you get to pick u if you fix the Lagrangian as r plus 1 over r, and then vary the kind of t?
It's r plus f of r.
And f becomes u.
Yeah, that's right. They're equivalent choices. That's right. So there's an infinite number of versions of this theory because of that function, and then this is just one simple version. You might think, again, infinite number of versions of the theory, how would you ever rule it out? The answer is you then do what you should do in cosmology, which is calculate the evolution of perturbations. And here's what happens to perturbations. In lambda CDM, this is the two gravitational potentials for time-time and space-space parts of the metric. In lambda CDM, it goes down when the cosmological constant takes over because the universe starts accelerating and the potentials actually diminish a little bit. They're suppressed by the expansion. In modified source gravity, they go up in a way that depends on wavelength. So these are short wavelength modes that really go up very far, and longer wavelength modes are unaffected. And you might say, well, you pick a bad u of psi, you pick a bad value of the function. But the nice thing, if you are trying to rule things out, is that the same constraints that make the universe accelerate at late times tell you that small scale structure is going to blow up in this theory. I would like to therefore say the theory is ruled out. I can't really, because it's not quite consistent. We've made this calculation in the context of linear perturbation theory, but the perturbations go nonlinear when this happens. So I suspect that if you could do the full nonlinear calculation, it would still not be right, but I can't quite tell you that. What I can tell you is that the nice thing about this theory is that even though it looks like you have a lot of freedom, you make a unique prediction. If you modify GR in this way to make the universe accelerate at late times, you get a large boost to small-scale power in a wavelength-dependent way. So keep that in mind in your brain for the next 5 minutes. When I do my last example, which is DGP gravity, this is not at all the philosophy that we took, which is do the dumbest thing you can. Start at four dimensions and just start messing, see what happens. This is a top-down approach where DG and P said, if we have an extra dimension of space, so here's a brain, a free brain on which we are confined, all the particles of the standard model are stuck to this brain. We have an extra dimension that is infinitely big. Is it possible to get a consistent theory in which that extra dimension is flat? Rangel and Sundrum did it by making the extra dimension highly curved, so that even though it was non-compact, there was really a very small volume in there. DGP said, could we make this spatially flat so that it's really an infinite volume in the extra dimension? And they found that, yes, they could do that. The way they did that was by making gravity stronger in the fifth dimension, in the bulk. Gravity is weak on the brain and strong in the bulk. That shows up because there's a dimension difference here. So to make the units work out right, you have to take the Planck scale and divide it by some length. And if you make that length big, like the Hubble constant, you're making the effective value of the five-dimensional Planck scale smaller, which means that gravity is stronger. So when you have some object in DGP gravity, which has a Schwarzschild radius, if you're close by, what happens is that the lines of force from that body don't want to go into the extra dimension because it takes energy to get there because gravity is strong in the extra dimension. So the lines of force stick close to the brain and near to the body, gravity looks four-dimensional. If you go past this new length scale, which is just the Hubble constant, things look five-dimensional, but we don't observe that. But there is a crossover regime in which things almost look like scalar tensor gravity. So DGP is not exactly the same as general relativity in the observable world, but if you're very close, it does look like that. And the nice thing about this theory is that when DG and P invented it, they were not trying to make the universe accelerate. However, DFIA showed a year later that they do. So here's the Friedman equation in DGP gravity, one version of it on one branch. What you find is there's an extra linear term here, which means that even when rho is zero, you can get a solution to this equation when h is not zero. So if you imagine what the Friedman equation looked like with dark energy, h squared would eventually equal rho, which was a constant, so h is constant. In this theory, there's a solution when rho is 0, but h is constant, 1 over rc. That's an accelerating universe. That's the good news. The bad news, there's plenty of bad news about this theory. One is that the acceleration is mild. The equation of state parameter is, roughly speaking, about minus 0.7, which is on the verge of being ruled out. It's about the 3-sigma level excluded by data already. It also has theoretical problems with strong coupling, with ghosts, with not being derivable from some ultraviolet completion, etc., etc. We will ignore all of these things and ask, what about perturbation growth? The nice thing about this theory is that it is testable. There's only one parameter in there. And if you think about what happens to a perturbation in cosmology, it starts life at a small wavelength when general relativity is applicable, and it gets stretched by the expansion of the universe into this regime where DGP gravity would be applicable. So to make a long story short, this is our current best guess at the prediction for the CMB anisotropies in DGP gravity. This is the culmination of a sequence of papers that I first started writing with my grad student, Iggy Savitsky, in an EAT work with Wayne Gu and Yong-Song Song. Yong-Song just gave a talk here earlier this weekend. And here's the point, that at large angular scales, at the very largest distances on the sky, DGP gravity seems to give you more power in CMB anisotropies than you observe, than lambda CDM would give you. Lambda CDM already gives you more power than you observe. This is an interesting feature that is bugging us about the ordinary model, is that even though it fits the data really well overall, once you get to multipoles in CMB between 2 and 10, they're almost all below the prediction of lambda CDM. There's one above, a whole bunch below, and the quadrupole is very far below. So that's a problem. Had DGP moved the data, moved the prediction to here, I would have very different emotional feelings about it than I do right now. It seems to be in worse agreement with the data. You might be able to fix it up a little bit by allowing the spatial curvature to not quite be zero, but no one is encouraged by this, except for the one encouraging fact, which is that it is testable. DGP has a larger anisotropy on large scales than general relativity. The bad news for me is that the way that the fluctuation growth varies between GR to DGP is different, too many initials in the sentence, than the way the fluctuation growth differs from MSG to GR. That is to say, when we invented modified source gravity and looked at the cosmological structure formation, my personal hope was that what we would find is that every theory of modified gravity that makes the universe accelerate at late times has the same qualitative effect on structure formation. That is not true. The equations we wrote down for modified source gravity keep everything the same at large scales and modify things at small scales. What DGP does is keep everything the same at small scales and modify things at large scales. So it's not quite so simple, unfortunately. However, we still have the very basic lesson, which is that we do have a set of testable ideas. The lesson drawn here is that there are different ways to probe the expansion history of the universe, and complementary methods can tell us something about the behavior of gravity on ultra-large scales. You can look at purely kinematic probes that are sensitive only to the scale factor using standard tangles or standard rulers, and that's really telling you A is a function of T. You can also look at dynamical probes that are sensitive both to the scale factor and to the growth of structure. You can count clusters, you can do weak lensing, you can do the microwave background. People are already doing this. This has been emphasized by the Dark Energy Task Force report. But the lesson is that you don't pick the one of these that is the most precise and do it the best you can. You do at least one thing from this list and at least one thing from this list. If you did both of those things and interpreted them in terms of an equation of state parameter W and got two answers which were inconsistent, that would be evidence that gravity was doing something strange on gigaparsec scales in the universe. If they are consistent, then that is evidence that general relativity is right. You're having a new regime of testing Einstein's equations on the largest possible scales, which is nice. Okay, so something's happening in the universe. If you're not allowed to think that the universe is not accelerating or something like that, either the universe is accelerating or worse, which is okay. Dark matter exists in some form. There's some new degree of freedom out there that is sourcing energy, sourcing the gravitational field. We've detected its influence. We don't know what it is, and it's not to say that gravity is not also modified, but there's something out there that is not in the standard model. dark energy we don't know yet, but even though we don't know as much about the quantitative behavior of dark energy as we do about dark matter, it still is really hard to come up with a theory that gets rid of it. I encourage you to keep trying, but the attempts so far are not really encouraging. So, nevertheless, I insist that we should keep an open mind about this stuff. We're talking about 95% reportedly of the universe in the dark sector that we've only had a lot of information about for the last 10 years. We have this vanilla model where it's cold, non-interacting dark matter, smooth, non-interacting dark energy that fits the data, but maybe only because the data aren't good enough. I think we should keep an open mind about what is causing this and hope that the next 10 years of theory and observation are at least as exciting as the last 10 years. Thank you.
First of all, the DGP, the current crossover in the scalar tensor theory is generally covariant, and there is a crossover design that means that there is a generally covariant subset of a DGP, or DGP itself is generally covariant.
Well, in five dimensions, DGP is perfectly generally covariant.
But we test our theories in four dimensions. What happens in four dimensions?
In four dimensions, if you sort, I mean, basically what you would see is that you get exactly the Schwarzschild metric here. By crossover, what I mean is that the metric here is not the power law you'd expect it to be either in four-dimensional Schwarzschild or five-dimensional Schwarzschild. It's in between. That's all I know. There are, in fact, an infinite number of new degrees of freedom in DGP gravity because there's an extra dimension. Almost all of them are hidden from the intricate strong coupling.
Well, the source of the question was that it seemed to me that DGP has a stronger deviation from GR compared to the other models you consider in the scalar tensor theory. And that suggested to me, I mean, that's the interesting part of the theory.
You mean in terms of measurements or in terms of how the theory is formulated?
How it's deviating from the observational curve that we showed.
No, I mean, it's pretty close. It's like a 3 sigma deviation, both for, I mean, these are the error bars. This is the cosmic variance. And so you see that if you didn't have general relativity, all you had was DGP, you would certainly be worried that you have, you know, 6 points, or 8 points maybe, that are below the 3 sigma error bar. But you wouldn't panic quite yet. You would be thinking hard about it. But you wouldn't say, you wouldn't give up. On the other hand, you have a better theory, you have the red curve, so you're pretty close to giving up, I think. Yes.
Yeah, so a thing which seems remarkable from the point of view of general relativity is that you can make these modifications and not destroy stability. So I want to find the right way to ask that question. So these don't have these neither modification you discussed has Minkowski space time as a solution. But they
DGP does on a different branch of the solution.
Okay, so it does. So let me then ask the question, presumably there's no positive energy theorem the way there is in general relativity. That is, there's no proof that there's an ADM mass which is one sign. At least I've asked that question and I've just heard bubble, so I've never gotten a straight answer to that.
Well, on the self-accelerating branch, there are strong and reasonable claims that the theory is dramatically unstable. And then there are hand-wavy counterclaims. Because there are hand-wavy counterclaims that you're doing a linearized analysis in a theory that is strongly coupled and you have no right to believe it. That is not a counter-argument, but it is it's a strategy. So I think that the theory is likely ruled out by purely theoretical order. I think that's probably right, which I sort of alluded to. Look at that.
Okay, let's talk about yours. So it seems remarkable that you can change the Lagrangian from square root of GR to square root of G, an arbitrary function of R, and not destroy stability.
Well, our theory is unstable.
But your theory is unstable.
Yes. The simplest version we wrote down has an instability on the time scale of a Hubble. It's just scalar tensor gravity. There's nothing weird about it. So, but the potential for the scalar field is this. It starts at zero, it goes up, and it goes down. There's no minimum anywhere. However, the curvature is 10 to the minus 33 electron volts. So if you start
that
the
is,
solution.
You choose a really small parameter. You don't,
yeah,
you don't
put it up there.
10 to the minus 120, you just choose it.
Nothing that I've said is even an attempt to explain 10 to the minus 120. It just sets it equal to zero and perturbs it way little. And the fact that the perturbation is little, also completely unexplained. I mean, that I think that is the less. I've been working on this stuff for, you know, the last 8 years of my life. And what have I learned is that the good old model of cosmological constant plus general relativity is not only fitting the data, but it's hard to change. Not only is it hard to decrease the amount of fine-tuning that model requires, it's hard to change it in any way without increasing the fine-tuning noticeably. And that's an important lesson to learn about space possible theory.
Does Tebbis say anything about the expansion, about the acceleration?
Sure. In Tebbis, you can certainly write down the equations of motion for the universe, where you get the effective treatment equation, etc. And it turns out that quasi-remarkably, nothing happens. That despite all of these new fields, as far as the scale factor as a function of time is concerned, it's basically what you would expect from the good old ordinary Friedman equation. The quantitative numerical contributions of these new fields is subdominant. So you need dark energy and you need dark matter. And then you can fit the data pretty well. The one thing you can't really fit is the third peak of the cosmic microwave background. Once that is measured more precisely with Planck, if it agrees with the lambda CDM prediction, then Tebbis would be completely dead. That, I just looking at this, I would be surprised if it weren't, but I don't know about
it. It's unstable.
It is unstable,
it's
yeah.
One
I mean,
page argument. I don't know that it's been published, but it's such a short argument that the ADM energy is unbounded from below.
Okay. I'm not at all surprised by that.
I think one thing maybe that should be asked is what are we trying to do with all these theories? That is why. Produce all these theories when you have just lambda, you have just this lambda CDM model. So I think the answer is that it seems unnatural in some sense, maybe technical, maybe just colloquial sense, that you have such a small parameter that's not zero.
Yes.
So one wants something to explain it. Maybe the lesson you can draw from this, which echoes something that Lee said, is that a local field theory is not going to give us this explanation without a fine-tuning of its own. You indicated maybe even a worse fine-tuning. Maybe one should be going, since this is all playing around anyway, in a sense, maybe one should be playing around with non-local theories. Even the DGP thing must have some effect on those other degrees.
It does,
at the higher dimensions. So now, I'll sound a little like a broken record, but I want to say that there was a prediction of lambda being this value, not with any new parameter but causal set argument, that involves a radical non-locality in the quantum effect. Unfortunately, no effort has been put into making that a real, full, comprehensive theory. It was just an order of magnitude prediction, but it was a prediction, and it did turn out to be in agreement with the data. So I want to make a kind of plea to people to think of a larger class of theories, maybe inspired by quantum gravity, maybe by underlying discreteness, but essentially involving some sort of non-locality.
Yeah, no, I'm very sympathetic to that plea. I mean, I think that the project that I outlined here in this talk is a very sensible one to follow. It says, okay, give up on trying to explain why the vacuum energy is small. Imagine that someday the ghost of Sidney Coleman comes back and explains why it's exactly zero. Is it possible that we can explain why the universe is accelerating without vacuum energy? And will that somehow ameliorate some of these fine-tuning problems? I think that we've learned the answer to that. And the answer seems to be no. It makes the fine-tuning of these problems worse. And that's an interesting answer to no. You wouldn't have learned if you hadn't tried. And so given that situation, I think that, and given the absence of any believable calculation of the vacuum energy being this 10 to the minus 8 ergs per cubic centimeter, looking at non-localities in quantum gravity and stuff like that is absolutely timely.
And then just, I mean, the set explanation, it is exactly zero on average, but one is seeing fluctuations.
I think that's a question either for Raphael or for Lee. I mean, we have an intuition that if you open the door to non-local field theories, it will create large-scale effects and no observable, you know, lab-scale or short-scale effects.
Yes, and I hope someday those of us working on that will agree to publish a paper about it. But we have talked about it in the workshop here.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. So what about putting the weird properties into the dark matter, by making it self-interacting dark matter?
Right. So one of the more mundane use of the bullet buster is to put limits on the simplest way the dark matter to interact with itself. It's just its interaction cross-section. So if you're there's a whole bright future ahead, the dark matter game, and figuring out ways to interact with itself and comparing it to new kinds of data like this. The simplest ways to make the dark matter interact with itself or with ordinary matter allow it to cool and condense in the centers of galaxies and clusters, which is against what the data are calling for, right?
So that seems like easy to...
You have to be clever.
But my real question was, is there some way to get it to cause acceleration? Right? I mean, after all, if it's the bulk of the matter of the universe and it's accelerating, then it's going to drag everything else with it.
Well, it only started accelerating recently.
Well, yeah.
Now, I mean, this is something... I mean, it seems kind of simple, but it's worth driving home. If you want to explain the data, you need to explain why something new has happened now that what didn't used to happen. There's a number that is 10 billion years, 10 to minus 33 electron volts, that comes in somewhere.
Well, okay.
Because when at recombination and a nucleosynthesis...
Sure, yeah. So I'm not saying this is going to solve the fine-tuning issue, but, I mean, again, same thing. If there's some... If it's accelerating, but there's...
This is different. It's not that the number is that number. It's that there is a number, is what I'm saying. So
sure.
If you mess with dark matter, which has been dominating the universe for this whole thing, it's very hard to explain why the behavior just changed.
Well, no. I mean, so if it has a self-interaction that's causing, you know, some force that would be expansion force, then it's the same thing as a cosmological constant. I mean, it's not the same thing as a cosmological constant.
Well,
there's two effects, right? It's also attractive to the gravity.
It's the opposite. It's the opposite effect, sadly. This is a little bit counterintuitive. If you have a force between particles that is not the force due to gravity, in the limit where the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, you have a particle, and it's being pulled by all these other particles, and the total net force is zero. The relevant fact about that force is that it contributes a positive pressure to something. Sorry, is that right? No, sorry, centripetal force is a negative pressure, and that contributes to the energy momentum tensor of the stuff. That's the thing you should calculate, not the force on the particles. It's hard to get more than a third of the energy density in a negative pressure by a force. But just because something is hard, it doesn't mean we shouldn't think about it.
Isn't it possible that the acceleration that we're achieving is itself dependent on the model? And that if you use a modified source gravity or some other modification of GR, that the acceleration would not be part of that range.
Okay, this is the last question I will answer because people are getting ready to go. The acceleration we claim to observe is model dependent, but only in the sense that the models of the universe is homogeneous and isotropic on large scale. That's really all you need, and that there's no tired light or decay of photons or anything like that. As long as it's free propagation of photons through a Robertson Walker metric, then the universe is accepted.
Before thanking Sean again, I think maybe we should talk about it. I just want to say, so he's here all afternoon, and he's in office 462, so if you expect there, Sean again.